Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
It's me. My name is Justin. Hi.
Brian Brushwood.
Psh, that's what they want you to think. But there's one weird trick that will change your mind, and you won't believe what happens next.
Yeah. Well, boys, I'm sitting next to a stack about 421 pages deep of a manuscript that I wrote.
So how big a difference does it make to print it out and look at it in that physical way? Because... Well, go ahead.
One, I mean, just, you know, to quote a great man who talked about putting the nuts on Microsoft's table, there certainly is something to printing the thing out and looking at going, man, this is what I did for the last 23 days. You know, this is kind of cool to see that. And that certainly from a sense of satisfaction is one of the reasons I tell people get a laser printer. You can get an under $100 laser printer, you know, it's cheap. You can get toner, you can get paper cheap, you can print things out much more inexpensively if you're not worried about ink, if you do, you just use a laser printer. And it helps one just to feel like every time you do a chapter there, it's done. But more importantly, as you asked, is it's great for grabbing a chapter and just sitting down with a red pen, not in front of a screen, not in front of your distraction machine, and being able to see it. If you take part of the problem of when we try to edit our own stuff is that we even remember sort of the placement of words across the page, and we're able to sort of predict and jump ahead. When you change the layout even slightly, it forces our eyes to look in different places than they looked before. Printing it out on page is super helpful, and I find that I can make a lot of corrections doing that. So it's great for that. I have of my friends that, you know, who say, hey, let me look at this. Some of them want like print copies. So I'm going to be bringing, hand delivering a print copy to a friend tomorrow, so she can take a look at it, and you know, that's her medium. Justin prefers an ebook format, so, and that makes it a lot easier than shipping it to Oakland, I'll be honest with you. But you know, I can send him that. But it comes to, you know, sometimes from some people, if you want to get notes, you've got to give it to them a format they're familiar with, and then for your own purposes, it helps.
Which, I mean, I've edited Andrew's stuff in both ebook and print stuff. In fact, I remember because you're releasing Public Enemy Zero. I remember sitting out at a coffee bar, you know, like a line editing Public Enemy Zero, reading it for the first time and just being so excited by it. But it really is important that you give yourself some wins, you know, and like allow yourself to enjoy the positive milestones of a big, especially big projects, mm-hmm. when you are also demanding discipline of yourself, because it's so important. And if you don't do it, I think you have a tendency to let negative elements of the process affect your decision-making, which can ultimately be very harmful. You know, like self-criticism is something that in the most productive people that I know is both potent and controlled, because you need it to be fresh, you need it to have an edge to it, but you can't let it just dice up, you know, everything else that you're trying to do. It really is very important.
I think that you need to have that balance of wanting to embrace that and say, okay, like I have this manuscript next to me, I've got a red pen, and I've got, you know, a plan to sit down. And I did that with, you know, how to write a novella in 24 hours, start off as how to write a book. And I have my own little red line copy that I went through. And I did, and now every time I sit down to do that, it becomes much, much easier. I have, you know, more of these, you know, my little red clip versions of that. Because I know to become a better writer, I need to get better at editing my own stuff, at finding my own mistakes before my editor does, before I submit them to my agent. The more polished that manuscript is, the better received it will be.
And that's also, keep in mind, that's not just like a pride thing. It's not, of course, you want to put your best foot forward and you want to look good to your publisher and so on. But your publisher's job is to find the stuff that you won't find on your own. And if your publisher is acting, you know, like an editor, you know, finding small mistakes, then that's bigger picture stuff that he or she is going to be missing. And so in that regard, it very much pays dividends to self-police and make sure that what you send is the closest to finished version that you can do.
Yeah, and you learn a lot. Like, one of the things that I had to learn to avoid is word repetition. And that was a thing that I wasn't really conscious of. And I, in preparing Public Enemy Zero for paperback, you know, I had to make a decision to say, okay, I'm not going to go through here and line edit this thing because I will change this book substantially from what it was, and it will be written like me trying to write it now versus the guy who wrote his first novel. And this first version did pretty good. But I did go in there, and whenever I saw, as I was, you know, going through and formatting, I saw a the, something like yeah. that. And if I had to maybe tweak a paragraph, change that, but you have to find that balance and accept that if you say, okay, I have a way forward to getting better, then you're more comfortable. I just finished, you know, while I was writing this, the other night I sat down and I read Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, the book by Lynn Truss, which is considered, you know, one of the most popular books on grammar. And it's not a style manual per se, but it gets into the history of the different types of punctuation, why we use them, etc. She's very much I guess we use the term a grammar Nazi, and she's offended by improper use of grammar, we'll say. But it's very funny and amusing to read, and I'm moved on from that. Now I'm reading Steven Pinker's new book, A Sense of Style, which is a linguist approaches this and says, listen, grammar isn't this hard, fixed set of rules that we've inherited. Grammar is a living thing about understanding and being able to comprehend stuff. And he points out contradictions in Strunk and White, which is one of the classic style manuals, points out where they contradict themselves and says, you know, it's very useful. But keep in mind, they were wrong here, they're wrong here. And we know, as a linguist, he talks about passive sentences, the passive sentence. You know, when we write stuff, he says, listen, that's actually more effective and for memory retention than people realize. And you'll see people say, no, don't do it. It's too passive, too passive, too passive. It's like, yeah, but it actually worked better that way. So that's exciting to see, you know, somebody take a scientific approach to these questions. But anyhow, I digress. My point is, if you have a path to getting better and you know every time you write something, you can then make sure that the next thing you do, you will improve upon it, you'll be more willing to take that criticism. You'll be more willing to handle it because you won't look at yourself as being judged fixed in time and space.
That's the difference between a fixed mindset and a growth mindset. The growth mindset is constantly like, well, that is an accurate representation of where I am at this point along the journey, but that in no way indicates where we're going to end up with this thing.
Absolutely. And that's just having that path to getting better and willing to just, you know you have to start somewhere.
Well, you know, and it's, you know, to go back to seeing your work, you know, physically, you know, it's easy to let yourself get your mind on rails as you get really, really fixated on certain elements of your long-term project. Like for Andrew, you know, it's, you know, for writing a book, you know, it's outline, research, that's like a separate thing. And then you start your first draft and you maybe try to, you know, get as much down there as you can. And then it's taking it out and revising it and going over it again, taking some things out, adding some things in. You know, there's like all these very, very little, very, very important stages that make a final product. And if you don't kind of give yourself a palate cleanser or a refresher of like, okay, let me get done looking through this little peephole and then, you know, take a look at the big picture and then go back to looking at another peephole, you know, to focus your attention. It's a mistake I know I've made in multi-stage projects, you know, in getting hung up on micro and losing track of macro. And it's where I've seen, you know, like last night we had a big meeting with all the contender people and we saw our mock-ups and everything. And it was one of those things that looking at, you know, this week we're going to get back, you know, what they call the comped proof, but in reality is a $3,000 card game, you know, where, you know, we're going to get to see the box that will be hopefully on store shelves, that will be in everybody's home, that bought it. And it's like, okay, now even just seeing it, like we so underestimate how much these little moments can have gigantic effects on our mood, our work ethic, our discipline, how much we want to double down, how well we deal with other people, if it's a collaborative project. Like, it's just so funny how the little thing can just help out so much.
And a week ago, I got my first print proof back of Public Enemy Zero from CreateSpace. And I was so impressed by the quality that CreateSpace could do. This matte finish is just, it's glorious. And I sat down and I worked, you know, I figured out how to work in Microsoft Word and how to try to avoid putting numbers on the front matter, which you're not supposed to do. And I went through all this sort of trouble to make a book that I thought would look really professional. I got this thing and I held it and I said, this looks great. And I'm like, and I sent a thing to Justin. He's like, it looks great. He didn't see the whole thing. And I'm like, you know, I noticed that the way my paragraph control works, that there are sometimes these large gaps between one page to the next. And I'm like, and I noticed that on my chapter headings that actually I didn't do that here. I did avoid having the header avoid on there. But I'm like, you know, there's a couple things I think I would want to fix. So maybe this isn't the actual production version of it. I sat down and I went through this thing again. I used proper window and orphan control. I figured out what all those little settings were, and I spent, you know, 2 days trying to make sure I could format this thing correctly. And the end result was, I submitted it back and went and got my second proof. And finally I said, okay, this one is good enough. There are little things I would tweak in this, but I'm good. I go, but like the major ones I'm happy with, you know, this is a version that I think that if you got this, you would think it was, you know, it was
where did you go?
Formatted, et cetera.
I know that you tend to be somebody who's extremely practical when you know that there's something that you perceive that you don't know enough about. You just go out and you find out the information and you dive right in. So when it came like, you know, what did you say? Orphan control or something, like, is there a particular website or resource that you could recommend for finding that stuff out?
So the short answer is that I didn't know what the problem was. I knew that I had at the bottom of the page that like there'd be these chunks, because I said, wait, it looks like it's pushing a paragraph onto the next page. I didn't know what that was called. And then I realized that that was actually a setting for paragraph control in Microsoft Word. And so I unclicked that. I'm like, oh, perfect. It flows so much more better. But then I noticed that the top of every page was often starting right in the middle of sentences and stuff. And I said, that doesn't really look like a real book. And then I go look in the settings and I see something called window and orphan control. I'm like, what does that do? I type it in and I find out, oh, that's what that controls. You know, that's how you avoid that. And so I figured out what the setting was. You know, it's just hard to figure out where these things are. And then I wanted to do, you know, I had another thing for trying to output. I wanted to embed my fonts. Turns out you can't do that in Microsoft Word for Mac. And there are all these little things that, you know, you go like CreateSpace, like, oh, do this. Like, no, you can't actually do that. That's a lie. And so you have to, it's problematic, but I just kept asking questions. I didn't just say, meh, good enough. I've done that before. You know, I have a couple other books that I formatted myself that I said, eh, good enough. And I said, you know what? I'm not proud of these. I'm not happy the way these things look. And I don't really try to give them out or push them. Like, you know, I did this. I made a paperback version of Night School, and it's readable. But, you know, the font's bigger than it needs to be, and I didn't do the front matter right. You know, once you get past that, perfectly readable book. But I'm like, eh, well, you know.
And this is one of those things where it's like there's a reason people have jobs working for publishing houses, you know, doing their mm-hmm. best to make things, you know, look pretty in the right ways and make sure that it gets filed in, you know, discovery systems so that they can walk into the local Barnes & Noble and mention, oh, that Andrew Main book. And then, you know, make sure that it shows up on there. But
yeah, you know, and there is, you know, in my books – with HarperCollins, you know, there is a cover designer, there is a book designer, there is a guy whose job is to figure out what kind of font to use, what size font. You know, you look at the subtle little things like, you know, here where we'll have this much space, we'll put the number of the chapter here, we'll use the big first letter there, which I did not do with Public Enemy Zero. I said, nah, I don't need to go that far with you know the formatting of it. But those are very real things that they do. And the answer is that you don't have to do every sort of stylistic thing you can, but there's enough basic things you need to do to make it feel good that you should do. And it's finding that limit.
Absolutely. Man, I'd hate to cut it short, but we're already running late and I've got a lot of stuff for Cord Killers. Do you want to jump into picks and stuff?
Let's go to picks.
So, hey man, my pick is you guys should check me out on Dance Showdown, where I did something that was very terrifying for me, and I danced where the whole world could see me, and I didn't really think much about it. I just lost myself for 10 whole days and did the best I could in the situation I could, and then something kind of funny happened, because the episodes come out on YouTube on Tuesday, but they come out early on Vessel on Friday, and somebody said, congratulations. I was like, on what? And they're like, on being voted fan favorite this week. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? And I found out that our team was voted fan favorite, and we'll talk about it a lot more on Tuesday, I'm sure, when we talk about it on Night Attack. But all of a sudden, it occurred to me, holy crap balls, we could win this thing. We've got that kind of community that can make real magic happen. And I didn't know, because there are people who have bigger numbers, whatever that means, out there, but we've got a very, very passionate community. And it occurred to me that, that I know from my perspective that the less it seemed like campaigning was paying off, the less I would campaign for a thing. And it occurred to me that having an early start to the campaign where we win fan favorite, I mean, it just seems like maybe we should double down, try to win fan favorite this week, next week, and the week after that. And maybe we get ourselves a little bit of a reputation for being an unstoppable campaigning machine. And then by the time they tally up all the votes, who knows? Wouldn't it be crazy if we won a dance competition reality show because we had the most committed badass fans on the freaking planet?
I think you're selling yourself short, and you are a very lovable, interesting person on that program. And there are a lot of people independently voting for you. Obviously, we're turning out our own people, but I think everybody should go ahead and vote your conscience, as long as that's Brian.
Yeah, agreed.
Also, just go to Dance Showdown.
Dance Showdown, they got an interesting system. You show up, you sign up, you have to sign up to vote. Interesting. You sign up to vote just with your email and make a password, and then you got to watch, like, what, 30 seconds of
30 seconds, I think. But yeah. Then I think there's a limit where you can vote again so long as you keep watching the 30 seconds.
So this is one of those things where it's like it appears to be similar to like a American Idol situation, where it's measuring not only just the number of people who are fans, but the intensity of their fandom. And one other thing, my other recommendation, which is probably better, probably more important, is freaking The Dark Crystal is on Netflix. The Dark Crystal's on Netflix. Everyone go watch The Dark Crystal.
Andrew?
What heck of a segue. My pick is the book I just mentioned, Eat, Shoots, and Leaves by Lynn Truss. And Eat, Shoots, and Leaves is a good, neat overview of the history of grammar. And you find out about, you know, the where it come from. There are a lot of great little passages in there. Because it's always better to give an example of that. You'll find out about, you know, the madman who invented the semicolon. You'll find about great stories about, you know, the attempt to launch the interrobang. And do you know what the whole thing about what Eat, Shoots, and Leaves is about? You know, why that phrase?
Yeah, I believe I heard, I want to say it was an NPR interview. Maybe it was Radiolab or something, but it was the author of Eat, Shoots, and Leaves. It's the joke, right? The panda walks into a bar. He orders a meal. He sits down, says that was a delicious meal, and then he gets up, pulls out a shotgun, blows off someone's head, and walks to go. And they're like, "Whoa, whoa, panda, not cool." And he says, "Look it up in the dictionary, bro." And it says a large mammal that eats, shoots, and leaves. And that's the right.
Basically, yeah, you know, it's exactly. So what it is just the idea of the difference of a comma can make. You know, we had grandma for dinner.
Yeah.
One's delightful that you did. The other one is you're horrible cannibals.
I'm actually going to buy it right this minute because I remember really enjoying listening to the interview, and for some reason it slipped off my radar, so I'm going to get it.
And of course, you know, you have the classic rollicking cowboy album by the Possum Posse, Let's Ride, Boys.
On the importance of commas.
Yeah.
Justin, do you have a...
Yeah, so my pick is Star Wars Episode 7. Between Andrew and I, what do you say? $300 after plane tickets and all the redundant ticketing for opening night that we spent over this week.
Well, and there's going to be five guys. There's a five guys right across from the movie
yeah.
theater.
So yeah, we've learned nothing since 1999. This is something I'm very, very excited for. I was excited to not only buy the tickets for Thursday night, but also for Saturday night. I'm going to go to the new Draft House in San Francisco with Ashley. It's a weird place, man. It's a weird place to be. I'm back here. I'm excited about the Star Wars movie. I gotta find that first that review I wrote for The Phantom Menace. I feel like now more than ever I need to be reading that initial glow I had for a movie that is so reviled, rightly so now.
Let's remember the discussions we had back then and just the way I looked at you.
It's just I mean, listen, you know, it's just, all right. Anyway. You know, you don't just like, yeah. I was gonna all these jokes that are appropriate to make, but I'm super 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 excited. Even just because, you know, like, whether or not the movie's good or not, and I will cry if this movie's not good, but
it'll be fine. It'll be fine. The worst it does is that it's better than all the prequels put together. That is the worst I can conceive of this movie being.
The worst we go, it's cool. You know, we're like, it was cool.
Yeah.
But I'm really just excited for everybody to talk about a movie on this scale again. You know, like, it's so rare that this happens. And we've seen it with the Avengers and stuff like that. But even then, now that the Marvel movies are so commonplace, you know, if you don't see Avengers the day of, you know, it's not the end of the world. We're all going to see it and talk about it at some point. Like, this is just, it might be... In a fracturing media environment, the last time that everybody gets together like this.
The anguish that I had with a certain bearded man on the phone who was so worried about the idea that if we didn't get into the 7 o'clock show or the 7:30 showing, having to listen to everybody else talk about it, you know, the idea that, I just have to shut down the internet. I'm like, there will be a 20-minute span from when those people walk out and we walk into a theater. If you can avoid the internet for that long.
But there's still going to be that part where everybody's walking out and I'm just going to be looking and I'm just going to be trying to read their faces and I'm going to be looking for smiles and not frowns. And like, or if they're smiling too much, I'll be like, no, this is the same groups that gave The Phantom Menace a 20-minute standing applause break.
Dude, and by the way, that's the reason I do audiobooks instead of print books, because I can't trust my Judas eyes to be evaluating, I'm coming up to a chapter break. I bet there's some big thing that's about to happen around the corner. Oh, big block of text. Oh, there's dialogue coming up ahead. I'm trying real hard not to look.
I mean, listen, it's going to be amazing. I'm so excited to see it. But really, this is my it's a pick just because, you know, I love that we can all do this again, that we can all go see a movie together. That's going to be so
Wars.
And if it sucks, we'll be really excited about watching a Star Wars when Rogue One comes out.
Yeah, man. Dude, Star Wars.
Hey, listen, I know this. If it sucks, at least we get a Plinkett review. Like, at the very least, we get another Plinkett review.
Star Wars Episode 7 is the most disappointing thing since Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith.
That's my pick.
All right. I say we make it. I was trying to point out that they outsold the previous record holder for pre-sales 8 times over.
How many times have you watched the trailer?
Only the once. Because we're close enough to it now that I feel like only answers are around every corner. And in fact, I stopped reading the article that you sent me because about halfway through, it got into a very specific set of criticisms that I've been very good at not looking at. So I was like, don't want to think about that stuff. Blah.
I I've seen it about 17 times, and I've seen the fan cut of all of the trailers together about 15 times. I've watched Daisy Ridley cry about 50 times about the trailer. I'm just all in. I'm just, folks, I'm all in.
The BB-8 reaction?
Yeah.
Gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.